The Community Character Hour is brought to you in part by the generous support of Lori Goetz and Clem Yonker. Thanks to Lori, Clem, and all of you for supporting community radio in North Idaho. Good morning. You've tuned into the Community Character Hour. We begin each episode with a newspaper clipping from the past. What have we got today, Hannah?
Okay, this one's a bit of a curveball, but you'll see why it pertains to today's episode in a minute. For our newspaper clipping this month, I just did a search through our local newspapers for the phrase wild horse. And the very first thing that came up was an ad in the September 1st, 1927 issue of the Ponderé Review. It's an ad from the Gem Theater, which was in the 200 block of First Avenue near the corner of Bridge Street. The ad is for an upcoming movie, and it says, Rex, the King of Wild Horses, in No Man's Law, with Barbara Kent and James Finlayson. Death Valley, where desire was the only law, and might made the law for those who possessed it. But in this wilderness comes a force stronger than the strongest. Rex, the King of Wild Horses. Mm-hmm. Also, Charlie Chaplin in Shoulder Arms. And so, in 1927, this was still the era of silent movies, but they were kind of transitioning to talkies at this point. The Panada Theater wouldn't open until later that year. So this ad caught my attention because this Rex character seemed to be a very big deal, but I'd never heard of them.
And he's, yes, compared to him, Charlie Chaplin is a footnote. He's so who's Rex?
Yeah, so curiously enough, he wasn't a man at all. He was an actual horse. Rex, known as King of the Wild Horses, or the Wonder Horse, was a 16 hands tall Morgan stallion. In real life, he would have been a dark chocolatey brown color, but in black and white film, he looked dark as night and bad to the bone. And he acted like it too. One silent film director noted that if Rex got loose on set, the crew ducked for cover, running into buildings or even under cars to escape him.
Well, stallions were certainly known for their temper. And in the silent film era, there weren't the safety standards for our actors and crews and animals to exist on set cohesively, so I imagine that would have been a sight.
Yeah. So Rex's movie career began in 1924, and by 1927, when this movie came out, he was receiving top billing above his human co-stars. He was so popular and so valuable that by the mid-1930s, film studios secretly shot most of Rex's scenes with horse stunt doubles to ensure that their star wasn't injured.
Wow. Rex, the Wonder Horse.
Rex.
Okay. The King of the Wild Horses. This is an interesting topic here. Okay. I want to know more about Rex. I also, I'm trying to think of when's the last time an animal received billing above his human co-stars, his or her.
And made Charlie Chaplin.
Like Free Willy, maybe?
Just a little note at the bottom.
I'm Jack Peterson, and I'm joined, as always, by Hannah Combs, Executive Director of the Bonner County Historical Society and Museum, and Heather Upton, Director Emeritus of the museum. So how is Rex the Wonder Horse relevant to today's topic?
Well, I believe Hannah mentioned Rex was also called King of the Wild Horses. And so today we're going to loosely discuss a related topic, the Wild Horse Trail.
Aha. Okay.
Now it all makes sense.
I see. Okay. Let's see. Let's remember where we left off. This year of the community character, we've been telling the story of kind of the 19th century in our area before the arrival of the railroads in the 1880s. When we last broadcast, trading posts had been built and then abandoned. The Jesuit missionaries, or Black Robes, had come through the area converting the Salish to Catholicism. And John Mullen had built his overland road partly along what is now Interstate 90. I think we were about 1860 or so when we left off.
That's right. But there's another event from those years that's pretty significant. The signing of the Oregon Treaty in 1846.
And that's when they established the 49th parallel as the boundary between the U.S. and Canada, right?
Precisely. But they established the boundary without fully surveying it. So as we discussed with Mullen's Road, the crew that surveyed these major roads were often coming west from the other side of the country, and they had little understanding of the local geography. So when Boundary Commission finally surveyed the borders from 1857 to 1861, any existing trails were a considerable help for those laborious efforts. But long before that survey, and before David Thompson came south into our area, the Kootenai tribe had established a trail that went up the valley between the Selkirk and Cabinet Mountains, which connected Lake Pend'Oreille and Kootenai River before heading further north. And as one of these few areas not possible to traverse by canoe, these indigenous communities used the trail to migrate seasonally between hunting and fishing territories. So the Kootenais actually guided David Thompson and his crew down part of the trail when they were exploring this first area. And when David Thompson and Jacko Finlay moved on to the Spokane, Finn and McDonald, he stayed in this area with his wife from the Pend'Oreille tribe, and they used the trail to visit the relatives. So it's not just a great retail store here.
There you go.
Okay, so we're talking about a well-established trail that went north from Sandpoint, or north from Lake Pend'Oreille. How did it get the name Wild Horse Trail?
The answer to that has to do with one of the biggest motivating factors in the history of the West, gold. In 1860 and 1862, two large gold discoveries near Lewiston and Boise brought prospectors to the eastern reaches of the Washington Territory in droves, quickly inflating the territory's population. The new residents didn't want to have to travel to Olympia to assert their now considerable voting power in territorial matters, and they petitioned Congress to create the Idaho Territory, which President Abraham Lincoln signed into effect in 1863. The Idaho Territory covered present-day Idaho, Montana, and most of Wyoming.
So the mining hotspots were popping up all over Montana, leading to the formation of towns like Bannack, Hellgate, which is later Missoula, and Helena. But none can compare with the stories coming out of Wild Horse Creek, a tributary of the Kootenai River in British Columbia. This site, located near the site of Fort Steele north of Crane Brook, boasted its miners, where they were extracting the equivalent of $80,000 in gold every day. But the area was remote and required weeks of overland travel from the coast. The full Wild Horse Trail, as it became known, ran from Walla Walla to Spokane, Rathdrum Prairie, the Senawakateen, Bonner's Ferry, the Moya River, and Wild Horse Creek. As time was a precious commodity, in a bonanza, the race was on to find the fastest route.
And sorry to interrupt, but Senawakateen, that's the crossing of the Pend'Oreille River. It doesn't exist anymore, right?
Correct. But yeah, between what's now Laclede, and then Séniaquitine was a small village on the south side of the river across from it.
Across from Laclede. Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, there you go. Sorry.
Yeah,
That's
interesting because historically the Séniaquitine is like one of the most important crossings and especially to the indigenous tribes.
It was the first county seat, I believe. That's it was actually considered as the capital of Idaho.
That's amazing.
At that time because it was so important.
And the first ferry was established there too.
Yeah. And now it's just
Laclede.
Anything? Yeah, it's the other side of the river from Laclede.
Yeah.
That's where, if you were trying to tell somebody where to go.
Right.
Yeah. Today, kind of the best thing you can see in Séniaquitine is going to the cemetery, which is still there. And you can see a lot of, if you go there, you'll see a lot of these old family names that we've discussed in different episodes.
Oh my gosh. Field trip.
Okay.
So we've tracked the trail. Now we're in Oregon, and Oregon gained its statehood in 1859. It was the largest city. Well, Portland was the largest city with a population of 2,900, and it had seen wealth pouring in from San Francisco, which had a population of 56,000. So due to it being an epicenter for mining camp trade during the California Gold Rush, Portland wanted in on the action. But they needed to find a new untapped market. The wilderness to the north and east was promising, but access was still crude and really limited.
To understand how the pieces of the story connect, from Portland to Montana, Sandpoint to British Columbia, we owe a huge debt of thanks to regional historian Linda Hackbarth and the discovery she made in 2006 of the journals kept by Seth Lewin Pope, William Penn Abrams, and Miles Conway Moore. We can't possibly cover all of the characters of this particular web of history in an hour, so we highly encourage you to read Linda's book, Trail to Gold, to learn more about all of the people involved in this whole part of the story.
It makes me want to learn more about her discovery of these journals, too.
Oh, yeah. It's actually so fascinating. She was just kind of randomly... Linda used to live at the south end of the lake area, and she was just curious about the history of her home and was newly retired, and had time to go around to all these different historical archives. And she wound up going to the Oregon Historical Society just because she thought there might be something useful there. Spent a few days there. And I think her book says that kind of the last hour of the last day that she planned to spend there, one of the archivists found this dusty old box. And they're like, hey, something interesting might be in here. And it was all of these original handwritten journals that had never been really like processed in their collection. Wow. They didn't know they were there. They'd never been transcribed. And so Linda spent the next like 6 or 7 years going through all of these, photographing them, transcribing them. And they were this incredibly rich original source of information that no one had seen in a long time.
Incredible. Was she an author previous?
Yeah, she had written several books about the history of Bayview and Lakeview down at the end of the lake.
Amazing. I just remember when we were working on some exhibits, I could not put that book down. It's fantastic.
It's so good. I read almost the whole thing last night.
Trail to Gold is the name of the book. Linda Hackbarth, the author that we're talking about. And before that digression there, we were talking about, so we've got mining claims opening up in British Columbia, Wild Horse Creek, and
as well as some in Montana that are starting to open up.
Okay. And but the people mostly on the West Coast, how do they do it if the routes were still treacherous?
Well, it was a little bit of trial and error. So, and word of mouth, of course, as the prospectors figured out the best route to travel. But as they were competing with each other, few actually shared information that will allow others to get ahead. So it's like they were off to the races, but once the race started, that was it. It was the men who were not as interested in mining that were profiting from the entire system. They really figured out how to make the routes work best for everyone. So there were barriers that still existed despite the best efforts to optimize the routes to the gold rush. And some men profited indirectly by smoothing out these obstacles. So when Walla Walla merchants, Edward L. Bonner, John W. Walton, and Richard A. Eddy headed up to the Wild Horse Trail to strike a business opportunity in 1864, they found one earlier than they had ever expected. So when prospectors reached the Kootenai River, they had to haul their gear over several trips in canoes provided by the Kootenai tribe, and they had to swim their horses across. The three men made a tidy profit by building a ferry, hence Bonner's Ferry, and charging the prospectors to use it. Love that.
Yeah. So I think as you see all over the world, there are the people who think they're going to get rich by finding gold, and then there are the people who actually do get rich by
opportunists.
Yeah, finding an opportunity in the people who are seeking it.
I like to think of just like they were there to help.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Not make money, right?
Totally, yeah. Not opportunity. Yeah. So helpful.
Yeah. There's a famous phrase about that, I think. How do you make money in the gold rush is sell shovels.
Yes. And the more you can kind of like isolate yourself and make yourself the only option. Mm-hmm. So in these times, monopolies thrived. If you could kind of corner a part of the market, mm-hmm. you were going to make some money. Mm. But there were lots of people who were charging to this area to try to find their fortune. Miles Conway Moore was one such man. At 18, he was lured to the gold fields from his home in Wisconsin. But along the way, he was serendipitously introduced to John Mullen of the Mullen Road, who invited Moore to join him on a prospecting expedition. And probably assuming that this older gentleman had experience in such things, he tagged along, thought he'd make some money off of it. They made it as far north as Seniocotin, but Mullen soon after gave up and left. He and some of his, they were like, we're going to go check out this way. They didn't find anything, and they were like, I'm done. Mm-hmm. After that, Moore, who was short on funds since he'd put everything into this little jaunt, wound up working as a clerk in Walla Walla, where he met a man named William Lancaster. The two concocted a scheme to transport goods and tools to the mines in Kootenai country. In 1864, they set off on a scouting expedition north, making it again as far as Seniocotin, where Moore tried to operate a trading post over the winter without much success. Moving back to Walla Walla, he operated several other businesses, never quite able to tap into mining-adjacent profits. But he ultimately became a successful banker, and he was the final governor of the Washington Territory before it became a state in 1889.
Hmm. Well.
I love all these players.
Yeah. And he just bumps into John Mullen.
Right.
Yeah,
I think he had like, somehow they had made camp near the same place, and he invited him like over to his fire to chat and
have some beans. That's amazing.
And this would have been after the, well after the road.
Yeah, right? About 3 years after the road was completed.
And it's funny to think of.
Or actually, the road was probably just kind of wrapping up at this point.
Okay.
Because I think Mullen went back east shortly after. Maybe this was his final.
Yeah, I always have the vision that he's like, you do the Mullen Road and then you find him as well. This is my road. Welcome. Yeah. So an older, more experienced visionary with the power of financial resources at his back was John C. Ainsworth, president of the Oregon Steam Navigation Company. So that was headquartered in Portland. He and his fellow company directors knew the Columbia River held the key to transporting people and goods throughout the Northwest Territories. And just remember, steamboats at that time could carry huge weight loads compared to other transportation methods.
Due to the existence of Cascade Rapids, just upriver of Portland, and Celilo Falls above the Dalles, steamboat travel had to be broken up into three sections on the Columbia. from the ocean all the way up to Walla Walla. Following this piecemeal approach, in which prospectors could get most of the way by steamboat and use pack animals in between, Ainsworth quickly built a near monopoly on the Columbia River systems, establishing steamboats on every navigable river near mining claims. A sternwheeler on the Snake River served the Boise and Owyhee gold fields, and another made the dangerous 260-mile journey from Kettle Falls up to Revelstoke, British Columbia. Much trickier by far was figuring out a way to access the claims in Montana, the elusive Pend'Oreille route.
But a well-known system of overland trails was already established from Walla Walla north to Spokane, then Senawakatine. But from there, the shores of Lake Pend'Oreille were mired in mud, making it all but impossible to travel to the foot of the Wild Horse Trail, much less up to the Clark Fork into Montana. The only other route into Montana at the same time was the Mullen Road, but the weather could be so treacherous that the prospector might get waylaid for months going that route. So a steamboat that could bypass these obstacles and travel from Senawakatine as far as possible up the Clark Fork River was projected to double the Oregon Steam Navigation Company's annual profits. The dollar signs in their eyes set off a great expedition led by young Zenas Moody, later the governor of Oregon, and William Penn Abrams. So while Moody was commissioned to build the steamboat that would ply these waters, Abram was directed to chart a viable waterway into Montana. The company men back in Portland were anxious to beat out any competitors, and so sent the two men on their way at the end of February of 1866.
February.
Wow.
Okay. That's, why didn't they wait until summer, I guess would be my question. Why'd they send him out in February?
Worried about the competition?
Yeah. At the time, profiting off of a gold rush was akin to other types of risky financial ventures you might see today. A rush could go bust at any time, so time was of the essence. But to your point, it was definitely foolish to leave on this expedition at the end of February.
Okay. And what they're trying to figure out is from Senawakatine, mm-hmm. across Lake Pend'Oreille, and then this is, of course, before there's dams.
Yep.
So how far could, I don't know if you know this, but how far were they thinking they would be able to navigate into Montana?
That's what they're trying to figure out.
They don't know.
We're going to go as far as we can, because they know there are gold fields mm-hmm. over in the, like, Missoula, kind of starting in the Missoula area mm-hmm. and east. And like you had mentioned, they had already figured out how to position steamboats into the kind of southern Idaho gold fields, into mm-hmm. the British Columbia gold fields. And this was the last one to try to figure out. And Montana was kind of booming at this time. So they're like, we're going to make bank if we can figure out how to get into Montana. But this seemed to be the only way. And it looked a little tricky.
Mm. Well, after that snowy ride from Walla Walla to Senawakatine, Abrams found that Moody's team was nearing completion on the construction of the Mary Moody Steamboat, which Zenas named after his wife, Mary.
Aww. Hmm.
So I'm going to read an excerpt from Linda Hackbarth's book, Trail to Gold, in which she describes the harrowing next part of Abrams' journey, just to kind of set the scene a little bit. With a crew of men, he set off in the two small boats towards the imposing waters of Lake Pend'Oreille in the unknown of the Clark Fork River. Their first obstacle was a still frozen ice at the entrance of the lake where Sandpoint later developed. They hauled the boats over the ice and made camp in the snow, sleeping as best they could in the bottom of the boats. The party finally reached open water the next day opposite the Pack River.
So that's unusual in my knowledge of this lake, that they're talking about this the whole north end of the lake is frozen.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Solid enough that
they can walk
20
to the
men
Pack River.
Can haul giant boats over it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's amazing to think. She goes on to say one crew and boat was left at the mouth of the Clark Fork with instructions to clear snags while the other headed to the south end of the lake amid a squall of snow flurries. Using their blankets as sails. The following day, they retraced their steps, sailing north about 25 miles to the mouth of the Clark Fork River, and soon found themselves 10 to 12 miles upstream amid the sheer 150-foot walls of Cabinet Gorge.
Uh-huh.
They were able to negotiate the rapids in the gorge by using a tow line and then found a place to camp for the night.
Wow. What an adventure.
Mm-hmm.
So as you're saying, this is before the dams. And their, Cabinet Rapids were pretty tricky ones. The one detail of this whole thing that I cannot get over is that they sailed to the south end of the lake using their wool blankets as sails in an icy squall, which means by the time that they got back, their blankets were completely soaked through and frozen. And then they're having to like try to stay warm at night with these giant, soggy, frozen blankets.
Oh my gosh.
It just sounds miserable.
Sounds like frostbite.
30 days into their trip, they reached another set of rapids near present day Knoxon, challenging the crew with a long and exhausting portage. After encountering more rapids at Thompson Falls, each set of rapids would challenge their hopes to get up to set up steamboat segments. So after Thompson Falls, the crew split up, one group carrying on up the river and the other on foot up the established Salish Road to the Buffalo. So they'd reached a point where they were paralleling an existing trail, and they were kind of like, these rapids have been really tough. Is this actually worth it, or should we just send people on foot from here on out? So they tried to explore both.
In their ways. And they're not finding a nice chunk of navigable waters, really. I mean, there's some, but every time they hit the rapids, it's like, okay, well, steamboat has to stop here. And another one is has to be built on the other side of it because you can't go, can't carry it over.
I was really impressed, like learning about the technology they were using to do these portages. Because when I think of a portage, I think of, you know, actually taking a canoe out of the water, carrying it over your head on land until you can put it back in. But these were big. I think they said they were 20-foot long boats that they're in, big, heavy boats. And so they figured out all these kind of like rope tow lines to drag the boats uphill or upstream from the shore.
Indeed. That's
quite an adventure.
Cool. It'd be cool to see.
It would be.
Not necessarily very fun to do.
I know, my back already hurts. So Abram succeeded in making it up the Clark Fork and then the Flathead River to the mouth of the Jaco River near Rivoli, then began the journey return. Well, we're
okay,
the return journey.
Right. So he's up, he goes all the way to Rivoli, Montana, or where what is now Rivoli, Montana. That's, there's a small town there. And then turns around. And that's...
Yeah. So he...
Rivoli's... Is that the junction basically between 200 and I-90? That's how I think of it now.
So instead of...
Or 293.
So instead of continuing to follow the Clark Fork toward what's now Missoula, he veers off at the Flathead River and then up the little tributary to the mouth of the Jocko River.
Okay.
And... which was his kind of goal. That was the area he was trying to get into.
Okay. Heading towards Flathead Lake,
I guess. So as he was traveling up there, he counted over 200 men headed to the Montana mines on foot while on their journey up the river, which is, it's incredible if you can imagine. They're like, okay.
These guys were like not waiting. They were slogging through.
Very intrepid. From Walla Walla to the Jaco River, they traveled about 350 miles during their 55-day round trip. Wow. Almost a month. Having provided an optimistic reports to the higher-ups in Portland, now the project was in their hands. It is always interesting to think, like, as they're exploring, that is their job, and they have to, like, write these amazing, like, letters, a little bit of salesmanship in there to continue, like, making the journey happen.
Yeah, and I'm always curious of things like this. Like, were these reports that they were sending back, you know, like, completely factual, or were they ever kind of
exaggerating the details one way or the other to be like, oh, if I say this, maybe I'll get to keep my job, or maybe I'll get out of this and I won't have to come up here again. Or,
I imagine that they were written to be advantageous to the individual that's needing that moment.
Very much so. Just a lot of people at play here.
Definitely.
A little rosy.
Right? Mm-hmm. 10 investors, including wealthy Amesworth, as well as a not-so-wealthy Moody and Abrams, took a huge risk by investing a total of $100,000 in this project. Wow. So careful calculations and a keen marketing sensibility worked in their favor. They targeted the unreliability of recent shipments of goods from St. Louis up to the Missouri River and into Montana, offering a better, faster, more reliable service.
So they were competing not just with the folks down in San Francisco, who, as the California gold rush was kind of drying up, were like, oh, hey, we need to tap into this new market. But there were already these established. So like when the Jesuit missionaries came out here, a lot of them took the Missouri River up from St. Louis. And so that was kind of an established route. So people were trying to compete from that direction as well. And they were like, oh, but they're not very good at it. So,
Okay, go ahead.
Well, they ended up trimming 50 miles off the trip by establishing a new port upriver on the Columbia at Wife Bluffs, and by porting the Mary Moody at the south end of the lake rather than at Senawakatine. So they're really kind of fine tuning this at this point. Mm-hmm. As a covenant juncture point with multiple landings, this one boat could take prospectors to the Wild Horse Trail headed up north or to the gold fields of Montana. Interesting. So with over 17 million found in the Montana territory, so $17 million, this was in 1865, this new venture had made the right bet at the right time.
Yeah. So pretty much any dollar amount we're talking about back then, multiply by 20, and that'll tell you
worth
how much money they're bringing out of those mines.
In White Bluff, I'm going to look this up right now. I need to see a map. So White Bluff is at is where it's further upriver than Senaquitine.
Yeah, and this stirred up a big controversy because Walla Walla had been the standard kind of jumping off point between the Columbia River and all of these trails heading up north. And they were not happy that they had set up a new site at White Bluff because it meant that all of the merchants down in Walla Walla were bypassed.
Oh, interesting. And
so they threw a big fuss and kind of started this Ponderay route marketing campaign where they were really promoting that people continue using the Mullen Road instead of this new approach that the Oregon Navigation Company was proposing.
Okay.
They had like signs in their yard.
Yeah. They were picketing. Yeah.
No Mary Moody.
Yeah. So what White Bluffs is up north, like north of the Tri-Cities on the... What is that? On the Columbia.
Mm-hmm.
And this was back in the day when, so at the time, Walla Walla was it the biggest city in Washington? I think I remember that from last time, or one of the major.
Yeah, definitely the biggest
population centers.
The eastern side of the territory.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Gotcha. And they're not keen on being, kind of passed over.
But it's amazing. Like, I'm trying to think of a modern day equivalent where this kind of boom and bust thing is happening so quickly that an entire town could be built and collapse within a matter of a year or two, just based on how a trail is rerouted.
Yeah.
And I guess that's why you see so many little like ghost towns.
Yeah.
Today. Yeah.
A lot of money exchanged in a quick period of time.
So, okay, where were we?
Yeah, okay. Lots of money. They were thinking they were going to help bring out of Montana.
Yes.
Right.
So much of this history would never have been known had not the journals of Seth Lewin Pope been donated to the Oregon Historical Society in 1915 after his death. Pope kept meticulous daily journals written for himself, not for his boss, which give us a fascinating glimpse into the life of this time. So as we had mentioned before, most of these guys were only making records for the company they were working for and didn't have any personal details in them. So Seth Pope is one of the first where we get to see a little bit more of a personal side. Pope moved to the Dalles in 1862. William Abrams hired him to work. So William Abrams, he's the one who Heather said was exploring the Clark Fork River. But this was before that. William Abrams had hired him to work in his lumber mill, and they became good friends. By 1866, Pope was working for Ainsworth's company and was sent north to deliver over 4,500 pounds of supplies to Zenas Moody. Upon arriving in Seniacotin, Pope, who was also a talented artist, made a sketch of the town site of Seniacotin, noting it consisted of a stud-constructed warehouse, a log warehouse, a log store, and four log homes, one of which belonged to Ned Cook, the ferryman, and one called a hotel that had a bar room at the front of it. He seemed a little skeptical that this was a hotel of any standard.
Oh, that's so interesting. So Pope and a man named Alfonso Boone were then sent down to the south end of Lake Ponderay to supervise construction of the Mary Moody's new port. They elected a bay they named Snug Harbor, protected from, I know, it's exciting, the fierce winds on the lake, but large enough to maneuver the large boat. Pope was not one to sacrifice his leisure work. In addition to building cabins and mapping potential port sites, his journals note the books he was reading and the fish he was catching, as well as the mosquitoes, thick and troublesome. Over the following weeks, they cleared brush, marked out streets, and built cabins. With the arrival of the two additional helpers, the four men built a small town in short order. The Mary Moody cruised down to her new dock on July 2nd, 1866. And with that, the operation was in business.
So I just love that they had four men build an entire town.
So impressive.
In a week or two. A town that was known as Ponderay City on the shore of Snug Harbor.
So the Snug Harbor we see today, right?
Yeah.
Gosh, it's hard to believe. We need a historical marker there.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
That's the, there's a sign for it out Highway 2, right? That's
yeah. What I'm thinking of. Yeah. So this isn't the bay where Bayview is. This is south of that. This is where Buttonhook Bay is. So you can go see it if you go to Farragut State Park today.
Oh, okay. That's not where I was thinking of. Okay. Mm-hmm. Interesting.
So though it was advertised to make its route around the lake twice a week, the Mary Moody was often operating every day to keep up with demand, keeping a crew busy cutting wood for her fuel. Ponderay City thrived as a supply depot for a few years, and they had two major ports. So one was stopping kind of at that beginning of the Wild Horse Trail, which would be near the Sunnyside Peninsula today. And then they'd go over and up the Clark Fork River to Cabinet Landing just before the Cabinet Gorge Rapids. But they could also be kind of called upon to make other stops as well. So they would stop kind of anywhere along the northern shore of the lake if people wanted, and even going as far downriver as Seniacotin if there was a reason and somebody was willing to pay for that extra side trip. Unfortunately, competition and, once again, shifting trade routes led to Ponderay City's decline by the 1870s. Despite the money invested and the dangerous undertaking of planning the routes, the company was subject to the pernicious mood swings of mining whims and shuttered the Oregon and Montana Transportation Company branch of the business in 1871. 5 short years after their dream was realized.
The Mary Moody, as well as two additional steamers built to keep up with demand, were scrapped by 1876. All that remains now are the comprehensive records, journals, and drawings that documented the efforts to open up travel access through North Idaho, hidden away for almost 100 years before the story could be fully told.
Okay. What is still left that you can see today, if anything, of this, all these, I guess, transportation efforts?
Yeah, that's a great question. So today, the Wild Horse Trail Scenic Byway follows roughly the historic path. So it begins in Sandpoint on Lake Ponderay and proceeds north through Bonner's Ferry via the U.S. Highway 95, then branches onto Idaho Highway 1 en route to Port Hill at the Canadian border. And a lot of times you'll see some really exciting highway markers, and you'll Wild Horse Trail.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was just, I spent last week up in Canada, and it was so exciting knowing we were doing this episode. I was like, oh, historical marker for this part of the Wild Horse Trail and this part, and just driving up there, imagining that you're on the Wild Horse Trail as you're driving by at 60 miles an hour, but like, oh, in a little like, on a horse, mucking through the mud.
So Hank didn't know it, but you had planned that trip to experience the Wild Horse Trail.
Yeah, basically, yes.
A little secret there. And in the back of the book, Trail to Gold, there's a trail supplement that offers information on 11 different trails from that period that you can still explore. I think that's such a brilliant thing. What a great adventure.
I know. I was just flipping back to the index of her book to look something up, and I was like, there's a whole section here on showing you where you can still see different sites.
So I take the Wild Horse Trail home every day.
You do?
Yeah. Nice.
That's exciting. I feel like my route is even more special.
We didn't talk too much about, and I know this is getting beyond your research a little bit, but the actual trail between Sandpoint, between Ponderay and Kootenai Lake. Mm-hmm. But that was really well established. So that voyage was not such an adventure, I guess.
So it was one of those things that kind of just grew over time. So there's a little bit in Linda's book where she talks about how it was, this kind of easy to navigate valley bottom was kind of shaped out by the Ice Age. And so going all the way back to the Lake Missoula flood era, things were already at work to kind of make this an easier way to travel. And then as the Kootenai tribe was living in that area, it was, like we had mentioned, generally travel by waterway was the easiest way to get around, but there were places where there just wasn't a convenient river or lake. And so this was one area where the Kootenai would make that connection overland between Lake Ponderay and the Kootenai River up near Bonner's Ferry.
Okay.
And then as you went north, I mean, the Kootenai River kind of winds all over the place. The next big body of water going north is the Kootenai Lake is not a natural lake. That is
a reservoir.
Okay. But that section of the river does kind of carry you straight north for quite a while.
Yeah.
So they would kind of, again, do a little overland jaunt over the windy parts of the Columbia up to that section. And so the Wild Horse Trail was what pieced all those bodies of water together. Okay. And then settlers were coming into the area, they were walking on the trail that was already there and then finding gold eventually. Mm-hmm.
These early footprints.
Yeah. And you can see as you drive it, there's no mountain passes really to go between here and Bonner's Ferry.
Right.
I mean, that's a very flat chunk of highway, pretty flat and straight considering where we are.
One thing I would love to learn, though, and I haven't come across it in any research, is what they did when that whole Bonner's Ferry kind of lowland would flood.
Oh, yeah.
So I think it flooded pretty regularly.
Yes.
So I wonder if there was like a kind of a side trail that skirted around that if you were traveling in the spring?
That's a great question. We'll have to plug into their local museum.
Well, yeah. There you go. They have a good one up there.
They sure do.
All right. We're going to pause here and play a little music. And we'll be back with more of the Community Character Hour right after this. Now, this whole thing we're talking about mainly transportation, of course, but why? What brought it on? What was the real driver behind it? Well, maybe this song will tell you a little bit more about it. You're listening to the Community Character Hour on 88.5 KRFY. Shirley Bassey, Goldfinger, from the motion picture of the same name. A little song about gold for you there. It is the Community Character Hour. We're talking about what's been, well, the book was called Trail to Gold. And that's really what we've been talking about, is all these transportation routes that passed through our area, and including the early transportation on Lake Pend'Oreille that was spurred on by the gold rush that wasn't in this area, but was elsewhere, or the gold rush that was further north, further east, and people passing through on their way to it. Let's see. What do we, have we told the whole story of the Trail to Gold? What did we leave? any juicy tidbits we leaved out before we move on to the next?
Well, I know. We were like noodling around. There's so much to unpack with this particular topic.
I'd say one of the big things is this: her book is chock full of these little kind of mini biographies of all of the people involved. And I know we only touched on a handful, but it was probably still a little confusing to follow all of these different people. And that's kind of one thing that stuck out to me, is how many people had to be involved in a venture of this sort. And that they were all there from different backgrounds, had different motives, different income levels. And yeah, just there were so many people involved who were willing to take this pretty treacherous journey because they thought they were going to make a fortune off of it.
Yeah. There was so much money flowing. They thought if they could just get on site, they'd figure out how to profit from it.
Yeah. What's interesting to me is what makes places, these places like Pend'Oreille City at the bottom of the lake just doesn't exist anymore. Seine-Aquitaine doesn't exist anymore. But this is where people, when they first, you know, what we think of as the American civilization, the existing culture arrives, they're like, this is where we'll go. We'll go here, Seine-Aquitaine. We'll go here, south end of the lake. And then it turns out that's not where people end up living, ultimately.
And I think we'll have to investigate this, but I think this has to do with what's the easiest place to access on foot or by water versus what's the place that the railroad happens to go through?
Right. Yeah.
20 years from now.
Yeah. It just all grows up around that.
Yeah. It's interesting. But then a place like Bonner's Ferry still exists in more or less the same place.
Yeah.
Whereas Seine-Aquitaine is just gone. That's not where they decided to build. They didn't build the bridge there. So there you go. It's gone.
Yeah. Another aspect of this that is fascinating to me is that this whole period from 1860 to 1865 is the Civil War.
Yeah.
And this seems to be just this forgotten corner of the country where these guys are just doing their own thing while this huge catastrophe is happening on the other side of the country.
Yeah.
And I'm just so curious about why none of these men were expected to be serving in the war.
Right.
What their, you know, allegiances would be if they had? Like, was this at the time, did this feel like a whole separate country?
Sounds like that. Kind of an escape moment too for some people.
Yeah. Maybe some people came out here to avoid the war. You know,
Well, that's interesting.
That is, to think about the parallel of those two.
Right.
Moments in time.
I mean, this is something we'll have to do more research on. I don't even know what, you know, how much they would have known about what was going on and how much, I mean, they would, you know, they would have known something, but how much could they really follow the progress of the war? How could they, and how hard would it be to get back if you, if you did, it's like war broke out. How long does it take you to get back and, and enlist if, if you're interested?
Are you going to Astoria and then around all the way to the East Coast by boat? And is that how your news is getting to you?
And how much of the profits from mining helped support the war effort as well?
That's a great question. Or how much was just pocketed? Oh, that's fascinating.
What was this energy?
Okay, well, in our few remaining minutes, can you tease us about what's coming up? What do we expect for the next edition of the Community Character Hour?
I had an idea, but now we've had so many interesting questions to follow. I think it could be any number of these things.
Okay.
The history will tell us.
Yeah, we'll see what pops out of the textbook, and that's what we'll do.
Just
open up the big,
the giant book.
Open up the textbook
of history and knowledge.
See what, just pick a random page. See what it is.
That's not far from what happens.
Okay, let's talk a little bit about what's coming up for the museum. What do you, if people are listening, particularly if they're listening to this show live on August 25th, what is in the future?
Yeah, so we've mentioned this the last few episodes, but our summer walking tours are coming to a close. We have two more. So this coming Friday and next Friday, September 5th, if you're listening to this live, those will be the last 2 days that you can do the historic walking tour of downtown Sandpoint. Those meet every Friday morning at 11 a.m. in front of Elevate Realty at 212 North First Avenue. And you can get tickets at the museum's website, bonnercountyhistory.org. So don't miss that. If you haven't been to it yet, it's a ton of fun. And we have great docents leading those tours. And then you have to head over to the museum on Saturday, September 6th. We are going to have so many things going on. It is Free First Saturday. So admission to the museum is free. Thanks to our sponsors, Jack and Colleen Filipowski. We will also have hands-on history activities for the kids. We're going to have the Pioneer chores station set up so kids can come and, you know, wash laundry on a washboard. We'll have the mud kitchen. This will probably be the last month for that. They can get messy and play outside the log cabin there. And on September 6th, we are also having a huge yard sale. So I do want to note that we are not selling anything from the museum collection. These are all things that have been donated by community members to help raise proceeds for the museum. But we are hoping to get some really good, old, funky, cool stuff donated. So that'll be on September 6th from 9 to 2. And it'll be, right there at the museum as well. So you can come in, do your yard sale shopping, have the kids go play by the log cabin. And if it's hot, you can come in and enjoy the museum with free admission that day.
Perfect. So donations wise. I'm like... fall cleaning right now.
Oh, perfect. Well, it's the perfect time for that. So we will be accepting donations for the yard sale starting tomorrow, August 26th, and then through September 4th during the museum's open hours. So that's going to be 2 Tuesday through Friday from 10 to 4, and then this coming Saturday from 10 to 2. Please don't leave things outside the door. if they get wet or damaged, it just causes a lot of work for our volunteers. So do try to come in when we're open or call ahead to if you have to make other arrangements. We are not accepting any clothing. That's the one big thing. Other than that, nothing that the thrift stores wouldn't take. If you have anything really big or unusual, just give us a call and we can chat about whether it would help the museum if you dropped it off.
So fun.
Well,
picking heaven.
There we go. It's just about 9 o'clock. Anything for those people who are listening to the rerun on September 8th? Anything they can look forward to?
Ooh, we are looking forward to scheduling a lecture for the end of September or early October. Mm. The details are not finalized yet, so keep an eye on our website at bonnercountyhistory.org for more information.
Okay. Well, Hannah, Heather, thanks for sitting with us and telling us about the Trail to Gold and early transportation on Lake Pend'Oreille and elsewhere. We'll be back next month here on the Community Character Hour. You're listening to 88.5 KRFY Pend'Oreille. This is Panhandle Community Radio. Up next is Bird Note.